Good morning. You're listening to KBLO Portland. It's 8:59, and coming up is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Hear all about the People's Republic of Richmond, California, and how they're controlling rents, the constitutional crisis, and Trump's anti-Muslim travel ban, plus defeat in last week's Dutch election of a Trumpist candidate and party. This program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with Bassem Youssef, dubbed the John Stewart of the Arab world. He's the creator and host of the first political satire show in the Middle East. Tickets for this all-ages event with Bassem Youssef on Monday, April 3rd at the Newmark Theater are available now at portland5.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book, which chronicles the 15 years of successful community organizing to create the progressive transformation of Richmond, California. Again, that's A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore at 1715 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ballot Measure 57, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law for nonviolent property crimes, accounts for nearly half the women serving prison time in Oregon. And as Oregon legislators consider opening a second women's prison, a new report, Unlocking Measure 57, explains how the development of Oregon criminal laws over the last few decades has widened the net of defendants receiving mandatory minimum sentences for property offenses. The report calls on Oregon lawmakers to repeal Measure 57. Hear the report on Prison Pipeline, March 20th at 6:30 p.m.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Yes, folks, we are moles in the ground, and I'm proud of it. We make history, all of us working together. This is your Old Mole Variety Hour. We describe our show in a variety of ways. One is we provide hope in hard times, confidence in that other, better, necessary, sustainable, and radically democratic world. And we should be confident in that possibility, because that new, better, democratic world is happening. It actually exists all around us. Cities that have organized to produce clean, renewable energy and become near completely carbon-free. Cities who are building housing and making sure that landlords cannot gouge their tenants. We report on cooperatives in this city and around the world that are owned and controlled by workers. We report on the last 50 years in this country's dramatic changes in family relations and child-rearing, in which domestic violence and child rearing, while still too much of it, it's been greatly reduced, with people searching to develop collegial and nurturant and democratic relations. Last week, we reported on Richmond, California, from Steve Early, the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Steve reported on how working people in Richmond organized the Richmond Progressive Alliance. They've managed over the last 10 years plus some of organizing, educating, mobilizing to take over the Richmond City Council, displace a city council who took marching orders from Chevron, whose refinery was, of course, Richmond's biggest and richest employer. Today on The Mole, we again go to Richmond about how last year voters, supported by the council, passed a rent control and just cause ordinance, and that's just part of what they've been doing and are doing. Also on The Mole today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, they talk about the battle over immigration and Trump's anti-Muslim travel ban that some describe as a constitutional crisis. Finally, today we discuss right-wing populism and the defeat in last week's Dutch election was really important of a Trumpist candidate and party.
They say the economy is booming, though on this there's much debate. It depends on how well you're getting by. Development is zooming. Some folks think that's great, and now you can legally get high. But even that can't mask the pain that so many of us feel when we're paying so much rent. To be homeless in the rain is so nasty and so real. Looks like the good times have come and went. Rent control. Rent control.
Well, that was Dave Rotrovic's song, Rent Control. Dave is a great political singer based in Portland. His song, Rent Control, that does provide some security for working people. Next, again, we go to Richmond, California, where, as we heard last week, a very progressive group who organized for more than 10 years, they took over the Richmond City Council. Joe Clement, one of our engineers, a community activist, an accomplished musician and writer, he talks to Zach Ware, the rent control campaign coordinator for Fair and Affordable Richmond, about how last year voters, supported by the council, passed a rent control and just cause ordinance.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, I'm joined by Zach Ware to talk about rent control in Richmond, California. Thanks for joining us, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
Zach was the campaign coordinator for Measure L, which was what established rent control in Richmond last year. And he is here today primarily to talk about how that campaign actually convinced voters to pass this. So could you just start us out by telling us like what the basic things that were created or enacted in this Measure L were?
Measure L was a rent control and just cause for eviction ordinance that was passed by City of Richmond voters in the November 2016 ballot by about 65.2% of the vote. The ordinance in essence, establish rent control, which is a stabilization that caps rent increases at up to 100% of the consumer price index, which typically is about 1.5 to 2% per year. And it also establishes just cause for eviction protections, which means that if your landlord wants to evict you, it has to be according to a just cause that is in your lease or your contract that you signed with your landlord. So that then as tenants, you can have peace of mind that the commitment that you made to your home and that your landlord's commitment that they made to you is something that is going to be held to over time. And so you can feel peace of mind and stability in that sense.
Did Measure L establish relocation assistance or was that an existing protection?
Relocation assistance was actually not established in Measure L, but rather was voted on by the City Council. It was passed by the City Council in Richmond on December 20th last year. And the ordinance very clearly kind of left that space open for us to answer that question after the election.
And as many listeners probably know, we passed our own relocation assistance ordinance in February. Chloe Udale was elected last year at the same time that Richmond was passing its rent control measure. And we are trying to bridge connections between Richmond's example and what we're fighting for. Could you tell us a bit more about what rents were like in Richmond before this went into effect? What kind of rent increases we were seeing?
So Richmond is a working class town, a family town in the Bay Area. It historically has had the lowest rents actually in the region, but it also has the lowest incomes in the region as well. So, you know, Richmond is predominantly a Hispanic and Black community, and many of the rents that our tenants were paying after the bubble in 2008 was kind of in the range of, for a two-bedroom apartment, you might be paying maybe $1,000 or $1,200 a month for that two-bedroom apartment. But over the last several years, as the tech boom continues to surge throughout the region, we've been seeing $500 a month rent increases, $600 a month rent increases. Some tenants have gotten their rents doubled. And as you can imagine, this began causing very, very painful displacement for working families. And they were getting very aggressive, you know, 30 or 60 day eviction notices, which, you know, as you can imagine, if you receive such a notice in a high competition housing market like the San Francisco Bay Area, it really left a lot of our neighbors with no options, no choices. And it would result in a really radical shift in their lives. And we wanted to address that.
Before we talk more about the ordinance, I also wanted to ask you if you could speak to the legal environment that California has made for rent control and what you think listeners in a state like Oregon, where we don't have rent control, should know about that.
There is a statewide law in California called Costa-Hawkins, and it was passed in 1995. What Costa-Hawkins basically does is it restricts the boundaries of rent control to only apply to multifamily buildings constructed before 1995. And also, it establishes something called vacancy decontrol, which means that if your tenancy ends and you move out of your apartment, whether you're evicted or you move out voluntarily, then your landlord then gets to reset the rent at market rate at that point. And so, as you can imagine, with millions of single-family homes in the state that are permanently rented, by the way, as investment properties, you know, not necessarily a homeowner just leasing it out temporarily, and as well as hundreds of thousands of apartment units that have been built since 1995, this kind of creates a big gap in the housing market, where rents basically, you know, allowed to continue to skyrocket. It's created a reality in which having rent control under Costa-Hawkins is still much more favorable for tenants than having no rent control at all. But it's created an environment in which rent control is simply less effective, and we want to reform that statewide law so that can, you know, have strong rent control policies reinstituted.
Getting back to the ordinance, when I was reading some background for this conversation, I read that Richmond City Council had passed rent control in 2015. Why did Richmond voters have to pass Measure L to get rent control?
Well, there is a little-known law in the state of California that says that if you have 10% of registered voters in your jurisdiction sign a petition within 30 days of an ordinance passing, then the voters can freeze or repeal or force to the ballot that ordinance. Now, basically what happened was the California Apartment Association, the main landlord lobbying group in the state, spent over $150,000 paying signature gatherers to go out into the community, and frankly, they participated in a fraudulent campaign of telling voters that if you sign this petition, it will renegotiate for stronger rent control, when really it's a repeal of the ordinance. And so we got hoodwinked here. This kind of law in reality means that really only corporations have the ability to pay the incredible amount of cost and energy that it takes to collect these signatures. And so we're hoping that out of this experience, folks can check their own state laws to make sure these kinds of loopholes don't necessarily exist. You know, where our democratically elected governments are being overrode by systems that may seem democratic on the outside, but in reality, real people can't really collect 10% of signatures within 30 days. So it ended up harming us, and it forced us to then initiate a process of getting Measure L on the ballot and then passing it. And in that time, hundreds of our neighbors were evicted.
Mentioning that initial ordinance passed in 2015 reminds me of a piece of Measure L I don't think we really covered, and that is this rent rollback. And I believe that it rolled back to 2015. Could you explain how that works?
Now, under constitutional law, you can't simply require landlords to just lower rents, right? You know, that would be considered a taking. But the Richmond City Council initially passed rent control on July 21st of 2015. What we put into Measure L is saying that, we're going to go back to July 21st, 2015 as the initial base rent from which tenants have to, pay rent and then have their rents incrementally increased from there. Or the first date in which they signed their lease after July 21st, 2015. So if tenants, back in 2015, you were paying a rent of, $1,250 a month, and then in February of 2016, the landlord raised it to $1,900 or $2,000 a month. Then, effective December 30th of 2016, the rents would then get reverted back to the original $1,250 plus adjustment for inflation on top of that.
Thanks for clarifying that. When it was put to the vote, Measure L passed with almost two-thirds of voters favoring it. Was this a given, or do you think that the campaign for rent control had to convince a significant amount of people?
It certainly helps that here in California, especially in the Bay Area, that people know what rent control is. They're really familiar with the policy, and a lot of Richmond residents are folks who have been displaced from San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley, and they realized the importance of tenants' protections. When we knocked on doors, the conversations that we had seemed brief, and folks were really ready to support it. Now, that doesn't mean that, we're able to take this campaign for granted. The California Apartment Association in total probably spent about $500,000 in trying to defeat rent control in Richmond. In essence, we were blessed by, kind of the existing political understanding and conditions that exist in the community. Folks seem to be ready to pass rent control. It's a policy that folks wanted, and it was our job to run a campaign that, led forward a clear and visionary message about the future of our community.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm talking with Zach Ware, the campaign coordinator for Measure L, which brought rent control to Richmond, California last year. I think it's interesting that you underscore people's experience with San Francisco is maybe instilling them with some confidence around it, because everywhere else we hear about how California and New York are examples of exactly why we don't want rent control, and they like to trot out how even Paul Krugman's against it, and don't you know 90% of economists think that it's just bad for everyone. Did that come up at all, and how did you respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. It came up all the time, and so the industry's prerogative is to focus on the sticker price of new leases and say that, because the sticker prices of new leases are rising at a higher rate, that means that rent control is a failed policy. In reality, it doesn't call into account averages of rents that tenants are paying. And so overall, tenants are actually more stable, more financially secure under rent control. And also, what we did, frankly, was we expanded the economic conversation beyond simply the price of rent. Under rent control, community gets to enjoy an economic ripple effect that benefits our schools, because when our kids aren't being pulled out of their school every 1 or 2 years because their parents have to move to a new apartment because of rising rents, it allows our schools to actually get stabilized, and it allows for our students to function in cohort with one another. When your wage may go from 14-16 an hour to 15-30 an hour, you actually benefit from that raise that the rent doesn't come up and gobble it all up right away. So people have more money in their pockets to spend at local businesses, thus stimulating our local economy. And so when we kind of expanded this conversation more broadly about the economy in our community and how everybody benefits from rent control, that really addressed a lot of the fears that people were experiencing about the policy. And that goes for tenants and homeowners alike.
Now, up in Portland, as talk of rent control is making it into the papers more and into the news media, and the landlords are starting to respond, one thing we've heard is that, you know, if rent control is enacted, or if this tenant protection that has a financial burden for me potentially is enacted, I'm just going to sell off my properties. And they say that as a scare tactic of, we're going to constrict the supply, or really, we're probably just going to sell to one of these big, bad, nasty companies who, you know, isn't the good mom and pop like me, who's willing to sell out their tenants. Have you seen any uptick in multifamily dwellings or rental dwellings going on the market, or do you know?
No, not exactly. I mean, developers and property owners want to own properties in great places to live, right? And I think one of our strongest arguments is that rent control, frankly, makes a community a much better place to live and gives it the opportunity to be a great place to live. Tenants can settle down. They can have the confidence that they can really invest in their neighborhoods and participate in, like, local politics and take on community projects. And so, you know, we look at communities like in San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland, where tenants are a really deep and enriching part of the community's life. And that, in turn, benefits those same property owners and developers. And so, I mean, frankly, you know, I'd say ask landlords in San Francisco, you know, whether they've really sold off their properties over the years. And I think you have a lot of examples of folks who have held on for the entire duration because they know that San Francisco, that Berkeley and Oakland and now Richmond is also really prevailing over these last 10 years and becoming a high quality place to live. I think we're going to see a lot of our property owners stick with it.
So the ordinance contains language that, in bold letters, in one whole section it's about, says landlords have the right to a reasonable return on their investment. And then it describes this as a function of the consumer price index. What does this mean in dollars or as a percentage of the rent itself?
In terms of the dollars or the percentage of the rent, it's difficult to quantify it in that fashion. But my understanding is that typically rent boards look for about a 10% return on a given building. And also keeping in mind that one of the main protests that the industry throws at rent control is, well, with rising costs, you know, landlords are under threat of becoming underwater with their expenses. So their expenses are higher than the rents that are being assessed. Well, it's actually a very straightforward process in going to the rent board and basically showing your expenses, your pro forma that you would, you know, I would hope normally be keeping, you know, as a commercial landlord, where, you know, hey, this is what I'm setting aside for my reserve every year to replace the roof in 17 years and to replace my plumbing in 32 years. And this is how much needs to get set aside. But if those costs rise and you see that you're not necessarily making the profit that you're entitled to, then simply producing those numbers to the rent board, it's fairly straightforward, and you'll get a rent adjustment so that you are actually profiting.
So before we wrap up this on-air portion of our conversation, and you can tune into the kbu.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour website to hear us in an extended conversation, before we wrap up the on-air part of our conversation, could you just convey to Oregonians, Portlanders who are listening to this, you know, what rent control has meant for tenants in California and why, when it comes to a vote or when it comes to putting pressure on our politicians, we shouldn't shy from that because of what we've heard about California?
I think the number one reason why Californians continue to support rent control is because rent control and just cause for eviction protection makes our housing market work in a way that's consistent with how people actually live their lives. People don't want to live their lives moving from apartment to apartment every 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Folks typically want to be able to settle, and they want to be able to invest in their communities, and they want to be able to plan long-term. And rent control and just cause for eviction offers that. It offers that and creates a social and economic environment where everyone has the opportunity to thrive in their community, but he has the opportunity to participate fully as equal citizens, and that they get, you know, live their lives without fear, whether it's from their landlord or from the economic climate that's going on around them. And so I think it's really important to us as Californians. And I think that is going to be demonstrated in the coming years as tenants' movements have continued to have a resurgence, you know, throughout the state. And we're going to see changes in statewide laws. You know, the Costa-Hawkins law that I mentioned earlier probably is going to see some change so that, you know, we can really continue to enjoy these protections for decades to come.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Zach Ware, the campaign manager for Measure L, the rent control and just cause eviction measure that they passed in Richmond, California last year. You can listen to a bit more conversation between us on the web at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for coming on, Zach.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. And good luck.
Born I was in Poland, oh, thought I'd stay here, grow real old. Found a trade that paved the way, shelving books for union wage. Then the rent started rising like an unnatural tide. And best keep on moving or they will drown my hide. Found a flat in a house, rent was low, I tilled the ground. Then the landlord sold us out to developer profit hounds. They took our rent money and tore our home to the ground. And built and sold four houses, some very modern cash cow.
Well, that song, Portland Tenant Blues, it was written and sung by Joe Clement, who also interviewed Old Mole Joe Clement, who also interviewed Zach Ware from Richmond, California. Speaking of Richmond, last week we talked to Steve Early, the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. That was Richmond. If you want to hear about more about Richmond, Steve will be speaking tonight about the Richmond Progressive Alliance, how it took power. It's enacting radically democratic and sustainable policies right now, rent control being one of them, and that's even in the time in the time of Trumpism. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Portland State University Bookstore, no charge. One final issue on rent control in Oregon, rent control by cities is now prohibited, preempted by state law. A bill now is pending in the legislature to make it possible for cities to enact rent control. A local Democrat, Rod Monroe, has come out against it. He reportedly has several buildings and he rents apartments. His number, Rod Monroe, the local Democratic legislator, is 503-986-1724. You might call that number and ask him to reconsider his opposition to rent control legislation, to legislation that would permit cities to enact rent control ordinances. Stay tuned on the Mole for the defeat of right-wing populism in last week's very important election in the Netherlands. Next on the Old Mole, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about the battle over immigration and Trump's Muslim travel ban. Jan and Mike.
Yeah, two federal judges in Hawaii and Maryland ruled against Trump's revised travel ban last week, which was imposed on people from six majority Muslim countries, as well as the suspending the refugee resettlement program for 120 days. And these two federal judges temporarily blocked the ban from going into effect, which, hooray for them, hooray for the anti-Trump forces. But Mike, let's talk a little first of how much this revised executive order responded to the legal arguments and criticisms in play, and how much there's to celebrate in these rulings of last week. Let's start with what the revised executive order did, and then a bit on the rulings against it or suspending it.
Well, it did two things. The first thing it did was drop Iraq, because there were so many Iraqis who had worked with us, who had saved American soldiers' lives, who had been promised that they could come here, who had in fact come here and were set up families here. There was all sorts of connections of Iraqis with influential military people that made some horrific news stories and caused Iraq to be entirely dropped. And the other thing they did was sanitize the language. They got rid of all the language related to religion in the executive order. They secularized the text of their order.
And pulled the part of preferential treatment for Christians.
Absolutely.
So, but it was basically the same act with dressed up a bit or domesticated a bit. But and as Trump himself admitted, he in wanting to go back to the original ban, that the intents behind it were the same, and this was the basis for the suspensions, was that this is basically motivated by anti-Muslim sentiment, prejudices, and that's and that you don't have to go too far to define the political motives for this ban.
Yeah, what the judge did was apply what's called the Establishment Clause. The First Amendment to the Constitution prohibits Congress from the establishment of religion or prohibiting free exercise thereof. And the Supreme Court's had many decisions enforcing the Establishment Clause. The clearest command, it said, is that one religious denomination cannot be officially preferred over another. And the issue is, the government said, well, where's the religion in this order? Read the text. There's nothing in here about religion. But the Supreme Court decisions have also held that you don't just look at the text, you look at the context. And what's really driving right-wing websites batty is the fact that the court has quoted all kinds of statements by Trump himself and by many surrogates about what's really going on here. And several people, a New Yorker has gotten rather sniffy about it and said, well, what's this business of like requiring politicians to say what they mean? But actually, the idea of using campaign rhetoric or assuming that everything they say is lies is really too cynical. If they say something, they should mean it. And Trump repeatedly said, as a matter of fact, when I say things, I mean it. If I say I'm going to build a wall, I'm going to build a wall.
But even it wasn't just the right-wing talk show hotheads. It was even five members of the Ninth Circuit Court disagreed with this suspension of the ban, saying that you cannot, that there is a different context when you're running for office. Many things are said on campaign trails that then are thought through in a more systematic way or are manifested in quite a different context once politicians come into office, which on the face of it, there was some merit to that criticism.
Well, that's a
truism. Do you respond to that truism?
Of course that's true. The judge looked at campaign statements. He also looked at a wide series of statements made not only in the course of campaigning, but after the election.
So there was a consistent pattern.
That's right.
Of political statements, not just something thrown as red meat to the masses in a moment.
I know, and that truism of Kosinski was irrelevant. I mean, of course that's true, but the judge who
of course that's true that politicians say things on the campaign trail that are different from the situation.
Well, he's saying that they then later make more measured presentations, and that's very true as well. But the job of the judge was to find out what was the real intent of this statement, and they did a fine job of that, and Kosinski never said the judge was wrong about that. He complained about his method of over-reliance on campaign statements, but he never doubted or expressed any doubt that the judge had accurately determined what the purpose of this measurement was. And Kosinski, by the way, was piping in with no justification other than his authority as a longtime judge on the Ninth Circuit. There were 5 members who complained out of the 27 members of the Ninth Circuit, and they were grousing because they weren't chosen on the panel, basically, to make the decision. And they just could not restrain themselves and wanted to be heard from, so they issued a press release.
There's this interesting struggle between the left and the right wings of the federal courts that's in play here, among other dynamics. And it's not only the agility of legal scholars and how carefully they're able to put together their legal arguments. Of course, that's part of it, and that's part of what's fascinating about watching these court dramas. But there are different commitments, political commitments and worldviews in play.
Yeah, this decision is really impeccable. It's hard to challenge, but had it gone the other way, that would also be hard to challenge because there's much discretion. When you're trying to establish the context and meaning of something, there's so many different places you can go to for authority. And
I think part of the what's at stake that came up with the original federal judge Robart in Seattle was the power of the president, and should when there is an executive order of this magnitude that affects so many people's lives, should there be some rational grounds for it? And the lawyer for the administration said, it's not our job, not the job of the courts to opine the opinions or rationality of the president. And he said, are you saying that the president should not have any rational basis? He said, these 6 countries have no history of threats against the U.S. And I was surprised with this revisiting of the ruling that didn't come up. Why these 6 countries? And because there are many other Muslim-majority countries as well. Why this 6?
Well, business reasons primarily. Trump doesn't have any hotels there. They don't own, as Saudi Arabia does, about $1 trillion of U.S. currency. They didn't buy $59 billion, that's with a B, worth of American weapons, which Hillary Clinton touted as her major achievement as Secretary of State, and lubricating that deal.
Why isn't that summoned in the kind of legal jockeying for positions? Why doesn't it come into play? The judge in Seattle made an issue of that, but it wasn't the basis for the final ruling, apparently.
Well, rationality is not that important in matters of national security. And if we were to make a requirement of rationality, they could put major interests, in danger. I don't think, had Trump said that I'm doing this for reasons of security, and had he emphasized the extreme vetting for security reasons, there would not be a way to attack that, really. Because, look, for example, communists, people for decades were banned as communists, and it didn't really matter, if you wanted to get rational about it and see what kind of communists from what country and what had they actually done, it might all collapse. But the president is...
that's worth reflecting on as history here.
Yeah, the president is charged with managing these things. And had he not strayed over into the very touchy subject of religion, it'd be really hard to stop him.
So maybe that's something to celebrate here, that this is a very undisciplined man that's out of his lane a lot, as they say in the
exactly.
military. And that that's maybe exposes a lot of the irrationality and brutality of the state. There's the window dressing here is very thin, very flimsy gown. I won't stretch for more metaphors. At any rate... So there is something to celebrate in just in the last few seconds. What would you say it is? what's there to celebrate here?
Well, Trump lost.
Yeah. Okay. So this skirmish, one for our side. So this Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the rulings last week by federal judges temporarily blocking Trump's new run on his travel ban.
Hello. I believe, do we Are we going to play Dave Rogoff's song on the second verse, Patricia?
Okay, I got it.
Okay.
Okay, I think we're gonna.
I'm just Fuller here.
Every day that passes, why we don't have rent control is an insult to the human race. Time to get up off our asses, take back the city that they stole, put the greedy bankers in their place with rent control. Rent control. 'Cause that's the way everything should be. Rent control. Rent control. The choice of a democracy. One more time. Rent control. Rent control. 'Cause that's the way everything should be. Rent control.
Yes. Rent control. Rent control. People who own the property in the world, there's only so much of it. We can't live on tops of the Himalayas either. They're pricing humanity out of their planet. It's a very interesting process. Not all of humanity, of course. Poor people will be loud. Those of us in the rich countries will survive longer, including around climate change. Anyway, that was Dave Rogoff's song, Rent Control. We're going to have to do a lot more than rent control with regard to the vast property holdings and their extraction from poor people. Coming up today on KBOO, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, commentary. 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein interviews now a familiar name, Steve Early. He's making the rounds. Also tonight at the PSU bookstore. He's, of course, the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of the American City. On the Ground Radio at 11 o'clock presents Chris Hedges on the Rise of Trump and American Fascism. And we want to thank KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you surely can become one if you go through our extraordinarily heavy vetting process. You've got to be human, and we assume you are, by giving to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate. Finally, on today's Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, today's host. I interview Alec DeYoung on right-wing populism. He was in Holland. He came by phone. The line had some static, which unfortunately got a little bit intensified. I hope you get used to it. It's a good interview with Alec DeYoung. Alec DeYoung, welcome to KBOO.
Glad that you have me.
Alec DeYoung is editor of Grenzeloos. It's the journal of the Dutch section of the Fourth International. It means without borders. The Fourth International was founded in 1938 by communists across the world who broke with Stalinism very decisively. During the long Cold War, they opposed both Stalinism and capitalism and were hunted down, repressed, often murdered by both Russian and Western security forces. But the Fourth International survived, become an important current in world socialism. Their headquarters in Amsterdam, where Alec DeYoung lives and writes and speaks. And if you don't read Dutch, you can find his work in English on the journal International Viewpoint. Alec DeYoung, the rise of right-wing populism has probably been the most striking recent development in world politics, Brexit in the United Kingdom, then the Trump super shock in the U.S. The next big world election was in your country, the Netherlands, last week when the Dutch Trump named Wilders, even more of a Muslim and immigrant hater than Trump, at least in language. It appeared that he and his party might become the largest party and thus form the Netherlands coalition government. But the polls that predicted that, they were wrong. The Wilders party did gain. It did not win. Before we discuss that election last week and what can be done, this was at best a partial victory. That is, that Wilders did not win. Tell us how you understand the rise of right-wing populism in the Netherlands and in fact, around the world.
Well, the rise of what I prefer to call nationalist populism has, of course, different causes in different countries. But in speaking in general about the rise of this new nationalist right wing in Europe, it has a lot to do with the collapse of social democracy and center-left parties that across Europe during the 90s more or less abandoned left-wing social economic policies and instead embraced free market policies. And that is one of the reasons that large numbers of people have become disaffected from the established center parties. And it's one of the reasons why in many countries, right-wing groups that were already existing before were able to find a new audience, a more substantial audience than they did before. And of course, this process accelerated after the crisis of 2008 and the failure of social democratic mass parties to protect their traditional base from the consequences of this crisis. What instead happened, of course, was that in many European countries, like in the Netherlands, social democratic parties actually implemented austerity measures. And that is one of the crucial reasons why there is now a social base for these nationalist, populist, right-wing parties that at least promise to protect people from, or at least a part of the population, from the consequences of what's called globalization.
In the United States, of course, the consequences for the working class, broadly defined, especially though the lower half of the 99%, has been enormously dire in terms of the precariousness of their life. And the Netherlands, sort of, it's seen, at least in the United States, as a welfare state. How does globalization affect working people in the Netherlands?
Well, already before the crisis, and actually since the 90s, when the Social Democrat formed the government coalition together with the right wing, there has been a long process in which the existing welfare state has been gradually weakened, and in which many social services, such as unemployment benefits, are no longer seen as a right that every citizen has, and more are treated as if they are a kind of privilege that people have to earn. So even if, compared to the U.S., things like Social Security are still better in the Netherlands, there is an increase of precarity and maybe even also important, an increase of the feeling among many people that their situation is more uncertain, more precarious than it was before. The Netherlands is one of the countries that's considered to have dealt with the crisis in a relatively successful way, especially when compared to countries in the south of Europe, like Portugal or Italy, or especially Greece, of course. But for example, the employment rate in the Netherlands for people between 25 and 54 is still 5% percentage points below the pre-crisis levels, and real household consumption is also still significantly lower than it was before the crisis. So there has been a growing feeling of insecurity and a growing feeling among large parts of the population that economically things are getting worse for them.
And why is it that this scapegoating of Muslims, why does anti-Muslim rhetoric work?
Well, especially for somebody like Wilders, a lot of the gains that have been made in a society like the Netherlands, gains like women's rights, but also the welfare state, are represented by Wilders as not the gains of social struggles, but as the product of something called Dutch values or Dutch culture. So his narrative is more or less that the welfare state is a product of Dutch culture, that the Dutch nation as a whole supposedly chose to form this welfare state. And it's now this welfare state that's under pressure, according to this rhetoric, from immigrants and Muslims, especially because a Muslim supposedly represents inherently alien and non-changing culture that is more or less a parasite on social services that have been built by the quote-unquote real Dutch people. So the Islamophobia of somebody like Wilders is part of his rhetoric about posing as a defender of the interests of common people. He's basically saying that either you can have a society that accepts Islamic and other minorities, or you can have a welfare state. That's the choice that he always presents. And it's a kind of exclusive solidarity where a group of people that's supposedly the real Dutch society considered to be deserving of certain privileges that immigrant communities supposedly are not deserving of.
This is Bill Resnick here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Alex DeJong, who's the editor of Grenzenlos, a journal of the Dutch section of the Fourth International. He also writes a lot in the journal International Viewpoint, and it's in English. We've been talking about the phenomena of right-wing. He calls it nationalist populism. Its ugly head is also very prominent in the Netherlands. There's a recent election. The right wing gained, but it didn't gain the victory that some polls were predicting. Alex, tell us a little bit about the election in the Netherlands. It doesn't appear that there's even a phenomena like the Bernie Sanders phenomena in the United States, which is in fact very promising in a lot of ways. Tell us about the election and its outcome.
Well, I think the elections showed a turn to the right politically, and this turn to the right in itself was expected, but it took a little bit of a different shape than many people might have expected. The far right of Geert Wilders won, but not as substantially as many people had feared, while the mainstream right wing, which was in government, largely maintained its electoral positions, or at least it lost far less seats than could have been expected. So there was a shift to the right, even though the gains for Geert Wilders were not as large as some people had expected. But still, Geert Wilders won substantially. He increased his seats in parliament by a third. And another element is that the other right-wing parties, the so-called center-right-wing parties, have adopted rhetoric and a political profile that is more nationalist and more outspoken right-wing, hard right-wing than ever before. So in a sense, they stole some of the vote that could have gone to Wilders by adopting Wilders-like rhetoric and positions. So it's not a very positive outcome if you look at it from a progressive point of view.
On the other side, though, the what used to be kind of a Labour Party, a Social Democratic Party, somewhat like the New Deal Democrats in the United States and the Democratic Party now, those people moved right and kept moving right and supporting globalization and supporting the austerity and the great cutting down of welfare state, the security that it created for a good life, especially in the Netherlands. That party was lost heavily in this election, and a lot of it went then to people who saw themselves on the left in one way or another. Netherlands has many, many political parties in the parliament also. How do you understand them, and what promise do they have?
For decades, the main center-left party was the Labour Party. And after the elections of 2012, the Labour Party formed a government coalition together with the right wing. And they chose to adopt austerity policies in cooperation with the right wing. So at the last elections, the Labour Party was severely punished for this approach. They actually lost a record number of seats, so never before has a Dutch political party lost this many seats in a single election. So they imploded, going from 38 to 9 seats, a loss that was even more severe than was expected before. The votes that the Labour Party lost partly went to a centrist liberal party, but other votes went to more left-wing parties. So the biggest winner of the left parties at these elections was a party called GroenLinks, or Green Left, who increased from 4 to 14 seats. And I think that it's clear that many people voted for this party because they were disappointed with the Labour Party and because they wanted to oppose the racism and the nationalism of Geert Wilders. The Green Left is traditionally seen as a party that's anti-racist and as a party that defends the interests of minority communities. So it's very positive that so many people chose to support these kinds of ideas. But overall, the left is still weaker in parliament than it was before the elections. That's one element. The other element is that the Green Left is a party that in the past has chosen to make alliances with the right wing as well. And it's a party that has chosen to support austerity measures in the past. So during the last election campaign, the Green Left campaigned on a more left-wing and progressive platform. So they, for instance, gave a lot of attention to the issue of climate change. But for me, it's unsure how much of this left turn of the Green Left is campaign rhetoric or a cosmetic change and how much of that will persist. I think it's not a coincidence that during the elections, their leader refused to rule out that they would form a government coalition together with the right.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Art. I'm talking to Alex DeYoung of Grenzelus. He's the editor of the Journal of the Fourth International. Is headquartered in the Netherlands. We're talking about the rise of nationalist populism all over the world, and certainly in the Netherlands. They did not win the last election, as Trump did, but they're doing better. The whole right is doing quite well, and the left is weak. One final question. Several years ago, there appeared in Europe a sort of consolidation of left parties. Syriza in Greece, Podemos and other formations in Spain, even in France, that at some point that they would challenge austerity and German social political economy, that is this punishment of the left and of the working class and of real predation by the elites over working class people. What happened to that kind of left thrust in Europe, and what are the possibilities of it, of a revival of a powerful left?
Well, I think throughout Europe, a lot of people were looking to Greece as the country with the strongest social resistance against Europe-wide austerity policies. And a lot of people had very high expectations of the Syriza government. So this also meant that at the moment that the Syriza government capitulated basically for the demands of the Troika, you saw a widespread feeling of disillusionment and hopelessness. And I think that the failure in Greece showed that the European left parties, or at least most of them, they did not have a real European-wide strategy to fight austerity. This plays out in different ways in different countries, but if you look at the Netherlands again, you can see that one of the weaknesses of the left parties that were challenging the Social Democratic Party has been also that they are not able to confront the growing racism in society, and instead they have tried to revive kind of idealized social democratic policies and focusing on purely social economic issues. And I think that has left a lot of room open for these far-right parties such as Wilders that use racist rhetoric to attract voters, of course, but also that because they create a kind of polarization in society among ethnic lines, they destroy feelings of solidarity in society, and they produce a kind of dynamic where, as you could see in the last elections here in the Netherlands, many people feel that left-wing parties cannot really change social economic policies anyway. So instead, they're going to vote for more or less progressive liberals, such as the centrist D66 party in the Netherlands, or even the Groen Green Left, GroenLinks can be described in some way as such a party. So a lot of people seem to have given up on one of the core ideas of the left, which is that it's actually possible to oppose austerity measures.
Well, that interview ended relatively abruptly. We saved you a set of goodbyes and discussion. That was me, Bill Resnick, your host today. I was talking to Alex DeYoung about the Dutch election and much more. That is why the left has declined and how the working class struggle is also waiting again to be ignited, as it will. We're going to sign off now. The music, you just heard a second of it, was Gimme Shelter, of course, by the Rolling Stones. The Stones were talking about not just housing that we've emphasized throughout this show, but the fear of war and social danger. Life for the bottom 75%, but maybe the bottom 90% has become very precarious. And a lot of the anxiety about that precarity is now focused and been focused by the right wing on immigrants and these foreign forces. With communism no longer a threat, they really found another threat in which to threaten people. This is KBOO Radio, KBOO-FM. It's almost 10 o'clock. I just want to thank a couple people. Oh, we're at 10 o'clock. No more thank yous. And you can listen to this whole show and, in fact, the end of the interview with Alex DeYoung on our archive. You just go to KBOO to Old Mole Variety Hour, and there it will be, this entire show. Thanks a lot for listening. Coming up on the Old Mole Air Cascadia, coming up on KBOO Air Cascadia and Locus Focus.